My guest is Stuart Brand. He's perhaps best known as the founder, editor, and publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog. The catalog was a compendium of resources for living the counterculture lifestyle of the times. From its initial publication in 1968, it went on to sell over 2.5 million copies in several editions and won the National Book Award. In 1974, Brand founded the Coevolution Quarterly, a journal of unorthodox cultural news. It is still published today under the name of Whole Earth Review. Before becoming a publisher, Brand worked as a photographer and a multimedia performance artist. He co-launched The Acid Tests with Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters during the 60s. In addition to his work in publishing, Brand was pursuing his other passion, computers. In 1984, he published the Whole Earth Software Catalog and organized the first Hackers Conference, which has since become an annual event. Last year, Stuart Brand spent 3 months teaching and researching at the Media Laboratory at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. It's a place for advanced study and research in new information technologies. He's written about his experiences and observations in a new book called The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT, published by Viking. Welcome, Stuart, to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I must admit that when I started to read your book, I suffered from what you call, in the beginning of the book, boggle.
Mm.
A lot of information coming very fast, a lot of things I just didn't really understand. Did you have that same problem when you went to the lab and then tried to make sense of it in a book?
I stayed boggled the whole time I was there, three straight months of great anxiety and discomfort. And in a way, the book was written to cure the boggle factor, not only for people going to the Media Laboratory at MIT, but for all of us who are going to be living the rest of our lives in the Media Laboratory of the world. And the technologies of communications are coming so thick and fast now that there's a feeling of kind of being battered by them. And the thing I wanted to do was help all of us get out in front of that. And so when something new comes along, we see where it fits in instead of wondering now what.
What's going on? Mm-hmm. What was it that initially sparked your interest in the lab?
Curiosity. I'd been around the personal computer thing for a while, and the horizon of newness had come down to about 3 or 4 months. And people were being interested in the next version of something that had been invented 5, 10, 15 years ago. And I wanted to go back further out in front, over the horizon, see what was really spooky and interesting out there. And turned out a place that all of that is converging is at this Media Lab.
And so you decided to apply to work there?
Yeah, I just wrote a letter to the director, Nicholas Negroponte, and said, hi, can I come work? And he wrote back and said, sure.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I'll say.
What was the nature of the work that you were doing there?
It started out being that I was working with a project called the Vivarium, which is an idea of building a sort of a virtual reality for school kids in which they can then invent organisms that live in this virtual ecology. It's a computerized scene that lives in computers and can either be played out by robots such as blimps that they have that they're sailing around in the big building the Media Lab is in. These blimps are learning how to be fish. And they're also doing it with extremely wonderful animation that kids can work with on computers. And while at the same time they're growing a garden and working with pets in the classroom and going to the beach and so on, they're also really inventing animals to see how they can live with each other in these virtual ecologies. So I worked a little bit on that because I have a biology background.
Tell me a little bit about these ecologies. Could you be a bit more specific? I'm not sure. I mean, there's, on the one hand, I think about animals and computers and immediately, you know, Teddy Ruxpin or something like that comes to mind. And I know that's not what you're talking about.
No, indeed. The idea is to have quite persuasive-looking creatures. And this becomes interesting because computer science can't do them yet. And the person who's pushing all of this, named Alan Kay, who's a research fellow at Apple Computer, is using this as what he calls a forcing function for research. So it's simply pushing computer science, artificial intelligence, and understanding of education for kids further than it is now in order to make this kind of thing possible.
How old are the kids that are working on this stuff?
These are grade school kids, 4th, 5th, 6th grade, things like that.
It seems almost that's the generation we should be working with right now because, I don't know, we might be too late.
Hard to say. The kids fall in love with computers so easily that and they are so immediately empowered by having direct access themselves to a lot of time with, you know, very ordinary personal computers. One of the other projects at the Media Lab is Seymour Papert's Hennigan School, which is an inner-city school in Boston that has just become an ecstatic place to go visit because the kids are so happy. I mean, they come in on Saturdays to mess with the stuff. I never went to school on Saturday. Then they're not being told to come in. It's just if you want to, you can, and they do.
At the school, they each have a chance to work individually at a computer. It's not like one computer for a classroom of 15, 20, 30 kids.
It's more like one computer per kid.
Yeah.
And then the teachers get to spread themselves around when they're with a kid. They're really one-on-one with a kid. It's not a situation of everybody having to wait for the slowest or anything like this. Everybody goes at their own pace. They're discovering that a lot of kids that they thought were learning disabled weren't. They're when they can program their own learning situation, as they do with the computers, they turn out to be perfectly capable. And once they get the confidence that goes with that, the whole notion of learning disability goes away.
Is that notion of doing things right and doing things wrong?
It seems to get caught up in that, because when you're programming a computer, kid or grown up, you never quite get it right the first couple times, and so you're constantly debugging. And so the kids right at the beginning learn that right and wrong is of no consequence. Wrong just means you haven't got it quite to work yet, and you fiddle with it until it does work, and you fiddle with it more until it works even better, and you're constantly improving the situation. This is completely different than standing in terror in front of the board and being told to spell something and getting it wrong and then dying 1,000 deaths.
Mm. This is just one of the things that's going on in the Media Lab at MIT. My guest is Stuart Brand, who has written a book on the Media Lab called The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT. You have been involved in publishing for a very long time, and with the Whole Earth Catalog, the Whole Earth Review, which comes out quarterly now, Whole Earth Software Catalog, all of it.
Sorry about that.
Whole Earth, in case you think
one of the very first ones was called The Last Whole Earth Catalog. Boy, were we wrong.
I know. Didn't you think we might get tired of this after a while?
Well, I got tired of it faster than other people did, I'm fearing.
How would maybe some of the other experiments that are going on at the Media Lab affect you as a publisher? Frankly, I don't know if you were struck by this. I certainly was. The irony of reading in a book about technologies which could in turn make this book obsolete.
I think books will be with us for a long time. There's such a mature technology, and they're you get so much for so little. I don't think there's a better bargain in our society in a way. So they're likely to be around. They'll be expanded upon. You'll have much more electronic books. You already have it in a way with the people who live by what's called electronic mail, which is personal computers directly communicating through the phone lines with all sorts of everything else. And in there's a vast realm of really a kind of a revival of letter writing in a way. I've seen several professional writing careers now started on these things, people just chatting back and forth online through their keyboards. And since the only way they have to interact with each other is the quality of their writing, the quality of their writing gets very good. Somebody pulls something off and prints it somewhere, the person who wrote it gets paid for it, and they're hooked. And this is happening in vast quantities out there. But it's one of those funny worlds. If you sort of know about and are involved in the world of electronic mail, it fills your universe, and if you don't, it somehow you're not really aware that it exists.
in the publishing industry, is there an experiment that they're working on right now where when, say, you are writing a text or a story, the computer can actually give you suggestions on how to edit it as it goes along?
A lot of this sort of thing. Basically, what you're getting is the thing about print on paper is that it's pretty linear. There it is. It's going to stay that way, and it has a beginning, middle, and end. And the quality of electronic print is that it's much more existing in the equivalent of three dimensions. It has depth. And so already when you're writing with an ordinary personal computer, you come to a word you're not sure about spelling. You can call up the spelling checker, and it'll tell you the choices that you may prefer to get it right. And by the way, this sort of thing with kids is great because it just defears that whole thing of spelling when you're very young. And that's one of the areas the Media Lab is working on. So what you'll see increasingly is books that, they'd be an expansion on these audio books that you get now that people are listening to while they drive somewhere. Only this might be one that you're listening to watching, selecting among, and interacting with in a very rich way. So an illustration, if you ask it to, can come to life and be a sound movie. A diagram can become an animated diagram which shows things which you can then run forward and backward in different speeds and different scales and so on. And you get the ability to really move in a much richer sort of data land. And this is all part of, see, the thing the Media Lab is doing is saying, look, publishing is not separate from filmmaking, is not separate from video, is not separate from audio and radio and music and all these other things. They really are all one medium now because they've all been hooked together by the technology. It's all basically computerized now, which means it's all completely malleable. And these separate traditions are stumbling over each other with mutual ignorances. So they're raising a whole generation of students who are completely adept in all of these things.
You wonder why someone didn't see that before.
The predictions I've seen started at the very end of the 70s from a MIT political science professor named Ithiel Poole, who wrote a book called Technologies of Freedom. That was really my major source for this book. And then Nicholas Negroponte, early in the 70s, started to anticipate this, and really that's how he sold the fabulous funders and sponsors they've got for this $45 million facility.
He said, look, General Motors, the list is endless. PBS is even interested in some of the things. 20th Century Fox is interested.
Film studios, yeah. The newspapers, the various broadcast networks, on and on and on. And 20% of their funding comes from Japan. Hmm. And you go right down the list there of NEC, Sony, Matsushita, on and on. And which then makes the Americans more interested because they're afraid that once again the Japanese will take some American inventions and turn them into products faster than we do. And it's the Japanese involvement is very interesting actually because they're sending researchers to the Media Laboratory to participate in the process. Some of the other sponsors do that as well. Hmm. MIT is thick and fast between academia and industry and government.
Government is interested in as well.
Well, the dear old Department of Defense has been funding computer science for well over 20 years now, and they're in it too.
Are they? What sort of experiments are they? I even hesitate to ask, but what sort of experiments are they interested in?
Well, there's one of the nice things about the Media Lab is there's no secrets, neither military nor commercial. Nothing is proprietary, and so everything is open to everybody. And so the spookiest type of stuff they simply won't do. But the non-spooky type of stuff gets to be great fun. So some of the work in understanding speech, for example, is in the whole nature of the spoken interface with machines is being funded by Department of Defense.
This is the idea of saying speaking to a computer, and the computer will then obey your
understands.
Command?
Understands. We probably won't have real understanding of spoken language, connected speech, as they say. Until well into the 1990s, but you can get it to increase its vocabulary where it can understand 60 or 100 words. The Media Laboratory is building on other things you can do with speech, such as that some of these devices can recognize who's talking, even though they may not know what the words are. And so they've done a demonstration called Conversational Desktop, which is basically a robot secretary who is infinitely patient, recognizes your friends. Sort of has a sense of who is extremely important, like your boss, and will interrupt a conversation you're having in the room saying so-and-so is on the line, but will take a message from people who are not of interruption scale.
I think I might be slightly offended if I call someone and the machine thought I wasn't important enough to be put through.
Well, the machine is increasingly an extension of all of our personalities, and so you wouldn't argue with the machine about that. You'd argue with the person.
Didn't the person who's demonstrating this particular conversational desktop wish that he could develop one that sort of recognized his mood and could say, oh, how are you feeling? Are you having a bad day?
He's working on that. I spoke to him early this week, and he refers to it as grunt language. And the computer can understand increasingly just from your pauses, your intonations, things like frame of mind. They're doing one device that directs people to a certain deli at the outside of town just by noticing whether the responses to some directions are short or long. Short responses tend to be, okay, got it, uh-huh. And long responses tend to be more like, wait a minute, wait, what was that again? No, wait, do I turn left or right? That kind of thing. So it doesn't know what you're saying, but it knows whether you're being brief or long about it, and then will either go into more detail if you're being long, say it again, or move on to the next thing if you're being brief.
I don't know. There's something about this that is reminding me a little bit of the television show Max Headroom, where, we've got computer control of virtually everything. In fact, I think you're not even allowed to have an off button on your television set.
I didn't know that part. I love Max Headroom.
Do you?
I think it's a real prefiguration of a lot of this there and just the kind of sort of pricking of the balloon that you want. And it's one of the good things about the Media Laboratory, that they have a lot of artists involved. Artists come swarming through, are constantly poking, taking these things farther than the engineers thought was possible, poking fun at it, wondering about the political consequences. The science fiction writers come through and bring out all of the dire scenarios that might emerge from these things. And that keeps it healthy all the way around.
Yeah, I'd like to talk a little bit about those dire scenarios and so forth a little bit later, but some more about what is going on there. The cover of your book is a hologram. Mm-hmm. Yes, a lovely little hologram. This was designed actually by one of the people that's working at the lab?
Oh, worse than that. It was invented by one of the professors there. Stephen Benton, several years ago when he was at Polaroid, invented what's called the white light hologram. You see it on credit cards now, for example. And a few years ago, it was used on the cover of National Geographic. We used it on the cover of this book just because it's such a – it can be so gorgeous. And they made this really jewel-like, very large hologram that depending on what light you look at it in, is extraordinary or merely interesting.
Let me describe it a bit. It's that sort of that optical illusion that exists when two faces look at one another, and it looks like a vase, or it looks like two faces, and inside it there are large letters, small letters, and it's that rainbow sort of thing you see on the credit card.
Mm-hmm. It has depth. As you look at it from different angles, you can see the depth. A 10-year-old pointed out to me that it's an optical illusion made of an optical illusion, which I hadn't noticed. And is actually, in that way, it's a pretty cover. It worked out. It was Negroponte's design, in fact, to go this approach. And then some of the graduate students, as usual, did all of the hard creative work to make it actually cook.
It kind of almost telegraphs one of the things that's in your book, Stuart Brand, the Media Lab. The first computer-generated 3D freestanding hologram, and it's a green Camaro sedan.
Parked right there in midair in front of you. General Motors, as you might have guessed, sponsored that particular research and is moving toward – they do clay models, as you know, figuring out the next model generations for their cars. And what this will allow them to do is cut that process short by several months. Also, they want to be able to do a life-size projected hologram of a car where they can really get a sense of what it's like to walk around if you have to get down to get into it and so on. I talked to Ben earlier this week and we got to talking about a – not just a projected hologram in what they call an alcove that you can sort of move halfway around it, but one that'll be 360, you can move all the way around it. And to do that, it would really need to be overhead. So what we came up with to do would be a hummingbird that would be sort of there hovering in midair. And as you go around it, its wings would flap in slow motion, and there would be perhaps the sound effects of slow motion, whoa, 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 of a hummingbird slowed way down.
Lots of things to look forward to. We are going to be talking more with Stuart Brand, whose new book, The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT, has just been published by Viking, in a moment. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air. My guest is Stuart Brand, a founder, editor, publisher of the Whole Earth Catalog, and he has just written a book on the Media Lab at MIT. Can we talk about some dire scenarios? Do you think you might allay my fears just little bit? My biggest fear was sort of as we get more technological and as we get these sort of personalized computers and we're able to do so many more things from home, that we're going to get a lot more isolated. We're not going to be having these sorts of conversations that I'm having with you right now. I mean, there's a chance that I could be talking to a video image put onto a plaster cast of your face and, and I would just be a voice and we wouldn't be having this kind of interaction.
I think it's a completely fair fret. And actually, the person who had it first was E.M. Forster, the Room with a View man, who wrote about this way back in 1913, a story called The Machine Stops, which I quote at some length later on in the book when I get past all of the optimistic here, the things that are going on, and get onto the what else might be going on part of the book. And the fret of the machine stops is that we would get so completely dependent on this kind of communication apparatus that when it goes down, we go down. And that's always the thing you worry about with computers. They all crash at some point. And if you're not, you've gotten so dependent, you're not capable of fixing them at that point at some level, then you're in deep straits. And I think that's one of the dire prospects. Another dire prospect is the fact that now that all information is increasingly computerized, including, for example, we're looking at Time Magazine article here. That photograph was digitally rendered, sent over satellites, and printed in various locales. The fact that it was digitally rendered means that it's completely editable. And so digital retouching is something which everybody can do, and we simply don't know how much they are doing it.
There was an example, I think, in for Rolling Stone magazine. There was a cover with Don Johnson wearing a pink T-shirt, and the original picture had him with a gun in a holster.
Right, right, right.
And the publisher didn't, Jan Wenner didn't want the gun, so what they did was take little computer bits of the pink shirt and kind of cover it up. And already our images, you know, have been altered.
It happened as early as 1982 when National Geographic moved a pyramid on the cover. They just shoved it over so it fit better in the picture. And the New York Times called them to task a little bit, and somebody pointed out that the New York Times had disappeared from some bushes from a picture, you know, somebody way down the line. So far as I know, there's no editorial guidelines on digital retouching. There's also no way to detect when it's happened. And in the political process, very often there are things which are photographic evidence of this or that. And the problem is photographs aren't evidence anymore. They can be anything that the person wants them to be. This has not really been discussed in public fora, and we don't have any laws that relate to it. We don't have any even journalistic practices about it yet. So it's one of the things that I think is potentially dire.
Are politicians interested in what's going on at the Media Lab because these things are going to be coming up?
They should be. So far, they haven't been. And I think one of the sort of themes I fell into there is that the structure of communications is so much the structure of the process of a society. It really is a political question in the first place. It's hard to amend the Constitution, but it's real easy to amend the whole structure of communications, whether it's taking the telephone system apart or changing some rules at the FCC. So this is a much more political area than it's been acknowledged to be. And then you have what I think is a serious grassroots, rather wonderful grassroots, this isn't dire at all, set of things going on where you have people simply taking over the technology, whether it's backyard satellite dishes, over 1.5 million of those in the country now, or people grabbing video cassette recorders because they can record on them, they can time shift on them, that is move a program from one time to another. Personal computers is another example of this. And the Media Lab has taken as its complete design approach is that everything they do is to move the power of broadcasting away from the center and out to the periphery, out to the individual on the receiving end. So we wound up calling it broadcatch is the kind of thing that you might be doing.
I tell you, I'm a little nervous about all of this sort of corporate sponsorship of what's going on at the Media Lab, because I have the feeling that eventually they're going to try to sell me something that I can't afford.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, something you want that you can't afford.
Yes, exactly. Or something that I will need because, you know, it seems as though once you go out to purchase something, invariably you're going to meet someone that says, oh, no, you should have had that. Or next week they come up with something new. It's like I feel a bit like the steamroller effect. I'm not going to be part of the steamroller. I'm going to be part of the road.
Right. Already the most quoted line in the book.
Is it really? It's a wonderful line.
When a new technology rolls over you, if you're not part of the steamroller, you're
part of
the road.
Wonderful line.
It's I don't think that's going to change. I think you'll see lots of different products coming from many more different parts of the world increasingly because this is more and more a global phenomenon, not only in terms of traffic and people who are using it, but, of course, in terms of source. I didn't know, for example, when I went into this that the U.S. is third in the line of movie makers in the world behind Hong Kong, and the leader is India, of all people.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we're seeing and I wound up looking at is, where is the global traffic in electronic communications? It turns out it's in entertainment and it's in finance. $87 trillion of the currency exchange last year in 1986. And there's no policy covering that. This gets back into dire country. There's also no body politic that traffic answers to. And there's no theory for how it's actually working. So the rules of the game change now almost weekly. There's a whole lot of computers in the process that I wound up calling robot investors, where the people are out of the loop, and we're back into a thing like war games where they take the people out of the global weaponry process and then things get scary. We now have a financial apparatus in the world which has some of those qualities, and it's very large, it's very influential, and it's not understood.
You are aware, you know, that you have been called what, a New Age Midas, countercultural guru, bellwether for an entire generation, intellectual gadfly. The list is endless. Do you consider yourself any of those things?
Oh, good God. Everything I touch turns to aluminum.
Seems to turn into nice income for you, but...
I wish. This one might, actually. This is the first time I've actually gotten royalties. Before I was Aussie, Whole Earth Catalog was a foundation, nonprofit, so all I got was a modest salary.
No, but the idea of sort of, I mean, I ran this by one of the people that I work with, a sort of spirit guide to the future, you know, let us know what's going on and how we can use it. And we sort of tend to trust you because we've known you for a long time, for the last 20 years.
All I am is restless. You
know, restless.
Come on, jazz me, people. Show me something we haven't seen before.
Is that impatience is one of the things that led you to the Media Lab?
It led me to the Media Lab, and it led me to saying at the end that impatience is not of the essence, that one of the things about the communication industry is there's a kind of a headlong quality to it. And it's really not needed. These are mostly luxuries by and large. And they'll change the structure of everything as they change. But we don't have to hurry there. Nothing is terribly threatened if it comes a little more carefully. And one of the nice things about the Media Lab is because they are looking 10, 15, 20 years into the future, they're not lurching there. Mm-hmm. They're really getting a chance to sort of probe out, try something out, let people think about it, let the commercial people see if there's a product there, and let the rest of us think about whether we want a product there, for example.
We only have a few seconds left, actually. I'm so tempted to ask, I wanted to ask you what you're doing now, but I think it's more appropriate to ask you what you're going to be doing next. Inventing your own future, I suppose.
Probably still assimilating a lot of this material. It is new, and I think societies want to take their time with seriously new things, and I'm doing the same with this stuff.
Stuart Brand, thank you very much for being with us today.
Great pleasure.
My guest has been Stuart Brand. His new book is entitled The Media Lab, Inventing the Future at MIT, and it's published by Viking. I'm Leanne Hansen, and this is Fresh Air.